more about their equipment, more about the art and science of radio and wireless. How does all this stuff work? How do I make it work better? Why does my transmission line or my antenna behave that way? Transmitters, receivers, transmission lines, antennas, propagation. Let's see, there's something like 26 or so, maybe 27 different kinds of ham radio. 2-meter repeater ham radio you're listening to right now is just one of the kinds. I don't know if we can call it a separate kind when we add IRLP and Echo Link, chat rooms, and the digital modes, and DRFM, and so on. It just goes on and on. This the subject of combining a microprocessor, computer-like device with radio is sort of what you got with your Wi-Fi equipment these days, with your cell phone. Who would ever thought that it would get this far where you've got over 7 billion cell phones in the world being used right now? There are more people with a cell phone than there are people who have access to a working toilet. Which is more important? An interesting question, right, Rob? The TechNet gathers people who do have questions. Some of the TechNets are more interesting than others. Very few of the TechNets are where John, Paul, I, and Hal are planning exactly what we're going to talk about. The majority of the subjects we talk about are the questions that you guys ask. So if you want the TechNet to be more interesting, you've got to ask more interesting questions. There is no such thing as a dumb question on the TechNet. Our philosophy is that when there's the biggest gap between what the guy knows and what he wants to know, where he can't even pose the question in the correct language, you think about it real hard, that's the question that should be answered first. It's because there's the biggest difference between what he knows and what he wants to know. We don't have that attitude of hey, your question doesn't come up to our level, therefore we're going to ignore it. But don't worry about asking a dumb question. There are people who say, hey, this may be a dumb question. Now, they sound embarrassed to even ask it. You don't have to sound embarrassed. If you got a question, ask it. As long as it's a subject of interest to ham radio operators. And let me drop it. And your next question is going to be, what's of interest to ham radio operators? Boy, it's an awful lot of things. A ham radio operator, from my point of view, there's a scientist in there trying to get out. He wants to know, how does that signal travel through that medium, the ether, the phlogiston, that they used to believe existed? How in the world does that solar energy, this electromagnetic wave from the sun, go through 93 million miles and get to us? And how does that signal you bounce off the moon, go through that hard vacuum of space and come back? Not one single electron leaves your antenna, yet that signal is there. What is it? And there's all kinds of speculations about that. I've had some speculations recently where I think that a radio signal is primarily magnetic. I'm not convinced that there is a significant amount of E-field there until that varying magnetic field hits the conductor of your antenna, and by Faraday's law, it induces a voltage in that antenna. So is there really a voltage there to begin with? Some controversy on that one. There are books being advertised these days by the Antennex company. Antennex, I forget what it is, but one of those books that they're advocating, let me drop it, has a whole lot of chapters on the subject of the cross-field antenna, or the EH antenna. Very controversial antenna invented in the late 80s, which, if I understand correctly, the inventor of that antenna thought that if you build a separate structure in the antenna that launches the E-field wave and a separate structure that launches the H-field wave within the antenna, that you make some kind of a huge improvement in size of antenna, bandwidth of antenna, efficiency of antenna, and gain of antenna. That if you somehow separate the two functions and launch them independently. And so the cross-field antenna and the EH antenna claims this benefit. And the evidence to date suggests that no, the antenna doesn't have an advantage. Quite a few people have tried it, and they're not really sure that they're seeing any great improvement. Quite a few of those experiments suggested strongly that there was a non-improvement. You can't separate those functions, so to speak. Let me drop. millimeter version of it. I've got a whole lot of websites that describe the grief of attempting to build this antenna and confirm that it has benefit. So it looks like it doesn't. As I said, I'm disappointed that there are books being offered now about that subject on the assumption that they are a great improvement. There's a new book that came out in 2016 from the ARL called The Physics of Antennas, Antenna Physics. Not quite as simple as maybe you'd like it to be, but well illustrated, gives you a lot of information about the history of the people, of the 17 scientists that one by one had to come together before you finally had Marconi and radio, so to speak. So it really begins in the late 1600s, the beginning of the steps that became radio, became wireless communication, and it's a rather good book, and I do recommend that. The way we run the TechNet is that people with questions or comments sign in by giving us their call letters and their name, and we take as many of those as there are, and usually in the list, we take them in the order in which they sign in. However, if you get a chance to sign in, and we don't get a chance to get to you before you go to sleep, so to speak, you can be number one on the next week. So anybody who didn't get a chance to be called after he signed in, the next week he'll be number one on the list. Let me drop it. So those questions of a general ham radio nature, and as I said, ham radio gets into a lot of subjects. A ham radio operator might very well be interested in radio astronomy, optical astronomy, gravity astronomy, and so on. Quite a few subjects of physics, because there's an awful lot of physics involved in what goes on within our wireless equipment. We do that for the first hour or so, depending on the amount of questions and enthusiasm. There are times that the first section goes beyond 2 hours, but it's more likely near an hour. That's followed by John, KC2WGB, who maintains the mailbag. He does the chat room. He monitors the Echo Link. I think he even keeps track of IRLP. So if you have trouble getting an agent word-wise, if you're using one of the remote methods of getting into this repeater, and we're too quick on the switch, and don't wait for the four beeps, therefore you're not able to get in, John, by way of his monitoring of those functions, knows about it, brings it to our attention, and we make sure that you get your agent word-wise. After Jan, that's John, chooses a few of the mailbag questions that were sent to him of people who don't yet have the right license or don't yet have the right equipment that can talk to us directly. They do it by way of that mailbag, by way of that chat room. And we take those for the first, that's the second function we do. That's followed by Paul, WS2N, our space expert. He'll be giving a space report number 211 of the series. And NASA's doing some very interesting things this week. I quite often ask him, what's the current mileage and mileage rate of Voyager, the deepest piece of space equipment that mankind has ever issued, something like 12 billion miles away, three times the distance of Pluto, 37 years downrange, launched in 1937, 37, 38, something like that, years downrange. And that QRP transmitter running about 10 watts is still talking to us on 8.5 gigahertz from 12 billion miles away. You say, hello, Voyager, and it says, how you doing? And he answers you at the speed of light. That signal takes 37 hours round trip time to get there and come back. Boy, is that TX. Wow. In miles per watt, nothing comes close to that one. Let me drop. So, Voyager, Juno is the one that was just put into orbit around Jupiter very recently, and so it's going to be doing some exciting things. There's many other spacecraft, so Paul brings us up to speed on those, and you can ask him lots of questions, because Paul has spent a good fraction of his lifetime keeping track of what the United States Space Agency, National Aeronautics and Space Administration, as well as the European and Asian space agencies. He keeps track of all of those. Some of them are doing things that we don't often hear about, but Paul keeps track of that. And so along the way, Hal, K6DPZ, will quite often give us the benefit of his many years of radio. answer. And quite often he does. There are people who, I'll ask people, am I too wordy? Let me drop a quick. And a good percentage of the time, the answer comes back, yeah, hey Dick, you're much too wordy. So I have on a number of occasions asked people who sign in with a question, do you want the brief answer or do you want the long answer? And quite often the answer comes back, please be more brief. Except when you get to my question, give me the whole answer. I want to hear the whole story on my particular subject. You can sort of see what's going on there. We of the TechNet do tend to go a little bit deeper because if you just scratch the surface on all subjects all the time, it can create quite a bit of confusion, quite a bit of misimpression. So, and sometimes the question, the answer might be a little bit too fast, a little bit too long for you to understand at all. That's not a real problem because everything we say is being recorded and you can play it back. It takes a couple more days for what we say to appear on the website. Let me drop it. Now, the Mic Number 1 and Mic Number 2 websites will give you a lot more information. Mic Number 1 is KC2NJI. That's Mike Perry. And he has something called TechNet. Wait a minute. AmateurRadio.tv. Go to the website of www.AmateurRadio.TangoVictor. There you'll find 10 years of recording of the TechNet. Choose the right year, the right month, the right week, and you can play back all of the TechNet. So if you're not able to stay up late enough tonight to hear your particular answer, so to speak, or say to hear the whole TechNet, a couple of days downrange, it'll appear on that website, amateurradio.tangovictor. You can download it into whatever recording device you got and play it back while you're on the train, while you're commuting, on your lunch hour, or if the 6 o'clock news is boring, you can do it then, if you know what I mean. Let me drop. And Mic Number 2 is K1MJM, and he's got a website called TechNet, LimonTechNet.com. LimonTechNet.com, and there you'll find lots of additional information about the TechNet. Articles that are written, pictures, graphs, you can download what's it now called? Smith charts and things like that. The Brown and Woodward curves you hear me talk about so often. These are the graphs that will tell you for any length of antenna, dipole or monopole like antenna, any length, any diameter, what is the impedance? What's the resistive component? What's the reactive component? So if you're forced to build an antenna of the wrong size, what are you going? What size inductor are you going to have to add, or what size capacitor are you going to have to add to create resonance, and what resistance adjustment might you have to do? And so one of the well-kept secrets is you can get any impedance you want at the center of your ordinary dipole. You can make the resistive component anything from 1 ohm to 1,000 ohms inclusive by doing nothing but adjusting the length of the dipole. That's an extremely well-kept secret. Let me drop it. If your particular dipole happens to be in the middle of a well-tuned Yagi assembly, and because of the rest of the interaction of those directors and reflector, your dipole ends up at 21.5 ohms of impedance, and you want it to be 50 ohms, and you want it to be 70 ohms, you do that by doing nothing but adjusting the length of that dipole. The driven element of your Yagi allows you to adjust the resistive component to any resistive component you want, anything from 1 ohm to 1,000 ohms, just by adjusting the length. Graph number 1 of the Brown and Woodward curves will tell you how to do that. Graph number 2 will tell you that for that particular length, what reactive component are you going to have left over? What size capacitor or inductor are you going to have to add across the terminals of the dipole to bring it back into resonance so that now the thing is a perfect match? You ask the average antenna enthusiast, amateur, and many antenna engineers, what do I have to do to make a 21.5 ohm impedance antenna go up to 50 ohms? Most of the time, they'll describe to you what kind of a balloning structure, what kind of a transformer-like structure is required to do that. Believe it or not, you don't need that at all. Just adjusting the length. That simple concept has been there in plain sight, hidden in plain sight. Let me drop it. That simple concept has been hidden in plain sight since 1945, when Mr. Brown and Mr. Woodward, I think they were working at Bell Labs at the time, made all those measurements. They went and really built all of those antennas and made the impedance measurement, real data. Various lengths, various diameters of monopole-like antennas. A dipole is really a pair of monopoles back to back. So you take any of their information for a monopole, that's the way they measured it, and double it, and now you get the dipole impedance, reactive component and resistive component. Since 1945, the data has been there. Various people have tried to come up with an equation that matches all that data. And in many cases, that equation does a poor job. You got the real data, real measured, under real good laboratory conditions. Believe it. I'm amazed how many antenna engineers go through a complete training process in all the schools they take, all the courses they take. They go through a 10 or 20 year apprenticeship process in really learning the nitty gritty, the ins and outs of antenna design. And the company or companies that they work for, and the scientists they work with, and yet they never hear about the Brown and Woodward curves. It's amazing how unknown this universal information is. Chapter 4 of every one of the four issues of the Antenna Engineering Handbook has that data in it. Chapter 4. And whenever I say that in a public meeting, at an IEEE meeting, quite a few of the antenna engineers in the office will say, in the audience will say, what chapter is that in the Antenna Engineering Handbook? And I say to myself, how in the world did you guys live this long without hearing that? I used to think that they were kind of foolish. It's not their fault. It's just the classes don't tell them that. Their friends don't tell them that. The apprenticeship training didn't tell them that.
And repeater, time out.
And so that amazingly universal information never gets transmitted. And we on the TechNet are trying to correct that. A huge improvement is required in the method by which we teach antenna design. As an antenna engineer, as an antenna designer, the main thing you worry about is, can I squeeze that antenna within the space that's available on this particular device that they're designing? I mean, all these other engineers have designed this thing, this handheld product, and over in that corner they got the power supply, in this corner they got the microprocessor, and across this area they've got the keyboard and the display, and there's a little bit of space that's left over. You as the antenna engineer have to put an antenna in there. And the biggest thing you worry about is, can I squeeze it in, and how the hell do I impedance match it across all of those frequencies? All those frequency regions and all those frequencies. So the biggest part of the antenna design is worrying about impedance matching. And those Brown and Woodward curves give you the bottom line. They give you the direct, straight from the horse's mouth information as to your particular physical layout of your antenna, its length, its diameter, the way you zigzagged it and whatever, what impedance am I going to get? Those curves tell you that. How in the world can information be more valuable than that? How in the world can that be a better kept secret? As you can tell, I'm amazed by that. Time I tell somebody that, they say, gee, why hasn't somebody told me that before? Okay, I'm off on a tangent on that one, as you can tell. At this time, we're going to take a check-in from people who do have a question or a comment. You're going to give me your call letters, your name, and the word yes, which means you do have a question or a comment. You need to sign in because you're listening. After 33 years, this is TechNet number 1612. By now, after 33 years of TechNet, continuously held for 33 years, we believe somebody is listening. This doesn't have to be proven anymore. Can we drop?
Repeater, time out.
Try to remember to wait in between each transmission for the four beeps to try to reset everything so that people don't get locked out. Double checking, yeah. We haven't locked out the other repeater. So, call letters and name. Typical sign-in might be WS2N, call, and yes. So, give me your call letters and name right now. K2RIW, the tech man.
NY9A, George, yes.
Okay, November Yankee 9 Alpha. Interesting set of call letters, George. Okay, we got George. Anyone else? Give me your call letters and name right now. with a question or a comment. I don't think it's ever happened before. We'll find out if tonight's going to be that night. We'll only get one. In which case, George, we're going to spend the whole hour discussing your subject. That's a little bit of a joke. Anyone else to sign in with a question or a comment on any subject of interest to ham radio operators? And there's no question, it's a dumb question. Don't worry about it. Don't be embarrassed. Give me a call with a name right now if you think you've got a question or a comment. K2RIW listening.
This is KE2KB. Name is Frank, and I have a question.
Kilo Alpha, Kilo Echo 2, Kilo Bravo, Frank. Well done, Frank. Thank you. And one last call. Anyone else to check in because you do have a question or a comment? Even what you think is a dumb question. Give me your call letters and name right now. Okay. There's a mystery guy who didn't give us his name, but we happen to know who he is. KE2EJ, our broadcast engineer for Channel 21 and Channel 13 locally in New York City and out in Plainview. So, lots of years of experience there in broadcast. I'm not quite sure, but if I had to make a guess, you've been a broadcast engineer for 25 or 30 years. Is that roughly the right number, Eric? KE2EJ, K2RIW?
Keep going.
35 years? Have I finally hit it?
A bit more.
Oh, fantastic. Sounds like you found an occupation you're going to stick to. You think this occupation's going to last? Okay, we're going to go back to George now. November Yankee 9, Alpha. Go right ahead, George. K2RIW, Romeo, India, Whiskey, and my name is Dick.
This is Al. What was your question? I had a phone call.
Late check-in.
Please, these are the quick answers. I didn't hear the question the gentleman had.
We've had no questions answered yet, and you've already been announced, Al. Who's the late check-in? Give me your call letters and name right now, sir.
This is KC2 Queen Yankee Whiskey. Name here is Joe, and yes.
Oh, we got you, Joe. Okay, we haven't had any questions yet. Our first questioner is going to be George. November Yankee 9 Alpha. Go right ahead, George. K2RIW listening.
K2RIW on the net. This is NY9A. I do appreciate the opportunity to ask the question of this poor goose body. And I know that there is going to be an answer coming from somewhere. I've become very interested over the last few months in the solar cycle. And I realized that, not all the lousy transmitting that I'm doing lately is due to the antenna that I'm using. I feel like what I'm seeing on internet and elsewhere, let me let it drop, is that have a down cycle in the solar cycle, and there just ain't as much push around as there used to be. So my question really is, when do things get better? Dick, I'll put it to you. K2RIW and the group, NY9A.
Let's see. I'm not a person who uses HF an awful lot. I'm a VHF, UHF, SHF amateur. I'm going to give you a couple of hints about what I know about the ionosphere, and that's what you're really talking about. That ionosphere is really caused by what the sun is doing right now, where the sun is in its sunspot cycle, how much ultraviolet radiation is giving, that creates that plasma in the outer atmosphere called the ionosphere. That ionosphere, being a plasma, is a conductive material. When you strip the electrons away from the atoms, and you've got this thing called plasma, it's a conductive surface, and that ionosphere, we call it reflection. It's really a more complicated process than that, but you could consider it reflection. That signal you send out with your HF antenna, 99% of the time, it bounces off the ionosphere, comes back down to Earth, maybe bounces off the Earth and off the ionosphere a couple more times before it gets between you and your buddy in Hawaii or your buddy in London. So that ionospheric reflection, I'm calling it reflection, but know that it's something more complicated. It's a complicated kind of refraction. It's extremely important. that ionosphere being there doing its thing, as opposed to you just sending that signal over the horizon without the ionosphere, that can easily make a 90 decibel difference in signal strength. 90 decibels is a big number. Let me drop it.
Also, Dick.
Somebody said also, Dick. But, yes, the ionosphere, when it's there, 90 dB really means you put one with nine zeros after it and divide that into one. That's the ratio of signal strength you get with the ionosphere versus without the ionosphere, rough number. So it being there makes a huge difference. You don't get that on 2 meters per se, because 2 meters, that signal goes directly from point A to point B. If I've got a good 2 meter Yagi on single sideband on 2 meters, on the average day I can talk to people in New Jersey, Maryland, Delaware, Virginia, quite often North Carolina, out to New Jersey, Pennsylvania, Ohio, up to the north to most of the New England states. You can get there directly on 2 meters with a single Yagi on the chimney, as long as you're not living in the valley, and 100 watts of power. And so you would think that the same 100 watts into an antenna of similar gain on an HF frequency would get the same kind of range. You would think so. Let me drop. And because the amount of atmospheric noise, I mean, you've got thousands of thunderstorms going on simultaneously somewhere in the world. So those thunderstorms are all making noise. You've got cosmic rays making noise. You've got a lot of things making noise. So therefore, the amount of noise coming into your receiver, you can tell this real fast by connecting and disconnecting the antenna when you're listening to, say, 80 meters. Connect and disconnect the antenna, and watch what the ears meter does. Watch what signal you get out of the loudspeaker out of your receiver. There's a hell of a lot of noise at HF frequencies. It falls off 60 dB per octave as you go up in frequency. So you're competing against a lot of radio noise that's present, and if that ionosphere acting like a mirror is not there reflecting your signal is there, but it's way below the noise, and there's a reason you're not hearing it. So the sunspot cycle, where it is, what the sun is doing these days to our ionosphere is a big factor. It sounds like Hal wants to give us a brief answer as to why we're not getting good ionospheric reception or ionospheric performance today. K6 Delta Papa Zulu, K2LIW. Go ahead with the brief answer on that one, Hal.
Thanks, Dick. Well, first of all, it's not only ionosphere. Oh, it's ether, and it's a 7-year cycle, Dick. I got a phone call.
Hal had said seven-year cycle, or he said 70-year cycle. I couldn't tell which. Almost everybody calls it an 11-year cycle. It really is a 22-year cycle, because the North Pole of the Sun is north, and the South Pole is south during one 11-year period. The Sun reverses its polarity, and now the North Pole, the northern end of the Sun becomes the South Pole for the next 11 years. So it's a 22-year cycle for it to completely repeat. But where the sunspots form, how close to the equator, how far up from the equator, there's a cycle that we have seen 23 or 24 times, that the various scientists have been studying it for the last couple hundred years. And so what that sun is doing is extremely important. It's putting out something like 10 to the 27 watts continuously, and we get a significant amount of that. Without that sun, as you know, we wouldn't be here. The earth would be frozen, water would be frozen, life wouldn't have formed, and so on. Very important. So, you ionospheric experts out there, anybody think maybe Hal's going to come back if he's off the phone? Anyone else is telling us that why is the sun not giving us the right amount of ionospheric performance right now? Anybody who feels you know something about that subject, give me a call that is right now. K2LIW in the TechNet.
I can't try. Take it real fast, Dick.
Take it as slow as you want. Most people call it an 11-year cycle, the sunspot cycle. Other scientists will call it a 22-year cycle, because you get 11 years of one polarity and 11 years of the next magnetic polarity of the sun. So why is the sun not performing as well for us right now, and when's it going to come back? That's what George has been asking us. K6TPZ is going to answer all of that. K2RIW in the TechNet.
I guess. Remember, I think it's a 7-year cycle on HF. And also, it's radiation into the ether. the medium of carrying electromagnetic waves is through the ether. That's the old name for it, Richard. Over.
Okay, George's question is, why is he getting so poor performance out of the sunspots? Why is the ionosphere giving him such poor performance lately? And when will it occur? When will it all come back to what he would like to be? That was his real question, Hal. Why is he getting so poor performance now? And when is it going to be corrected? Over to you, Hal.
We're in a very low point now. It's like a sine wave. We're at a low point now, it seems, and it's going to start to get better. It's a 7-year sine wave, you could say. That's primarily from my background experience, because I know many years ago, a 7-year cycle is when you started to see good propagation, and then you were on the lower end where you didn't have propagation hardly at all. C2RIW, K6DPZ, Mobile.
Okay, let me hear you. Let me repeat. The most direct question George asked is, roughly how long do you think he's going to have to wait for his antennas to look like they're performing well for the ionosphere to act in a desirable manner again? I'm going to add something to George's question. You could say, he's asking, do I have to wait 6 months? 3 years? 5 years? How long does he have to wait for the current dip in the cycle to become closer to a peak in the cycle? Over to you, Hal.
All right, WK6DPZ. Well, honestly, I don't know how low we are in the sine wave. What I've suggested doing is calling the ARRL, and they're very up on propagation, and they can get an answer. They may say it will start to improve in the next 6 months or a year. That'd be the best way to go at it, Dick. Get to RIWK6DPZ Mobile.
NY2H.
Okay, we've got NY2H and KE2EJ in that order. Go right ahead, Lou, first.
Good evening. Forbes magazine, June 27th, had an article, at least on the internet. It says Sun has likely entered new evolutionary phase. And if you read the article, they're suggesting that the 11-year cycle may be going away.
And that has occurred before in history, the so-called Maunder minimum. Roughly the 1600s, there was about a 50-year period of time in which there were no sunspots at all. There was the Maunder minimum, and there's also one of those minimums that have occurred. So periodically, maybe once every 150 years or so, the sun goes through a period of time where it becomes extremely quiet, and the sunspot cycle appears to go away. And those are periods of time, usually when we have excessive cold weather. Those are the periods of time when the Long Island Sound will freeze over and many of the Great Lakes will freeze over. So you have a colder period of time when the sunspot cycle seems to go away for a while. So the complete cycles of the sun, it's got the so-called 11-year cycle, which Hal thinks is 7 years, but many people call it 11. Some people call it a 22. And on top of that, there's another superimposing cycle of maybe 150 years. Eric, you keep pretty track of all of that, and lucky for you, most of your broadcast doesn't need the ionosphere. You've got to go through it with your satellite dishes to get your downlinks, but I don't think at your frequencies the ionosphere helps hurt you very much. KE2EJ, K2RIW, go ahead, Eric.
K2RIW, K2J. Well, we have to deal with something called sun outages, where the sun is directly behind the satellite that we're interested in. That happens at pretty regular periods. There's a period of something like usually 5 or 7 minutes where it's a problem. But we're usually well aware of it long before it happens. But the thing that I wanted to say is that, Mooja spoke about, that's been out there. Although we don't know if that's really for sure. I kind of doubt it. Anyway, Dr. David Hathaway, who is part of NASA's Ames Research Center and Solar Physics Group, he's been doing the predictions for many years, and where the full sunspot cycle numbers have peaked was around 2002, and the numbers were 100.
K2UPS has a comment.
Rich is on the list, but Erica, right ahead.
And the minimum down there, at the end of 2007. And we have the smaller peak of the other pole at 2015, and we're going down towards the minimum in about 2020. So we're on a downside, according to his calculations. By the way, his observations for the 40-odd years have been much done right on. So I just wanted to throw that out there. 2RIW, K2J.
Erica, how can the average guy get a hold of David Hathaway's latest information? I know that American Radio Relay League, in their monthly newsletter, at the end of that newsletter, there is a report about what the current sunspot cycle is doing. But if I wanted to go directly to David Hathaway, do I just simply Google that word, Google that name? What's the method by which I get to that information, Eric, that you believe is probably the horse's mouth? K2EJ, K2RIW.
All right, if you want to go directly to his website, you can do it by David H. Hathaway at Google, but directly into NASA is Solar Science, that's solar as in solar, science as in science, dot MSFC, that's Mary Sierra Frank Charlie, dot NASA.gov.
Okay, that's a beauty. Solar Science dot Mike Sierra Foxtrot Charlie.
Marshall Space Flight Center.
Beautiful, beautiful. Marshall Space Flight Center. Dot NASA. Dot gov. Okay, that gives us direct access to that information. Sounds awful good. Glad you gave that to us. And Rich NY, K2UPS, he's a guy who does an awful lot of QRP work, sometimes on top of mountains, where with battery-operated equipment running low power, with relatively simple but very crafty antennas that I've seen Rich set up on his recreation vehicle. By using very low amounts of power, he's very dependent on that ionosphere most of the time, I believe. Let's see how he finds out what the ionosphere is doing. K2 Uncle Papa Sierra, usually mobile, probably in Pennsylvania, I'm going to make a guess. Maybe you're heading east, so start off telling us where you are, how you're getting to us, and then tell us anything you want to, Rich. K2UPS, we want to hear from you. K2RIW in the TechNet.
Good evening, Dick, and the rest of the net. K2UPS Mobile. And I'm still in Ohio. Had a couple of slowdowns in traffic, so I'm not even in West Virginia yet, but heading home. I've never heard of a 7-year cycle. I've always heard of it as 11. But maybe what he's referring to is if you look at the sine wave and say when the sunspot number, the lowest point is 0, the highest point is 100, say the time between 20% to go to 100 and get back down to 20%, where you're ignoring the very bottom of it, you might have about a 7-year period of fairly decent good results, and a 4 years in between to make it 11 are not so good. That's the only thing I could think of where that 7 might be coming from, but I've always heard it as 11, and we're still on a downslope. But there's two places he can probably get some good information. One, the AARL just recently published a good book. I have it. I've loaned it out to a friend. It's written in fairly basic terms, but it does go into depth and explain things as well, just all the basics of propagation and how the solar weather affects radio transmissions here on Earth. Really good book to get, and it's available on the AARL website. I think it's maybe about $20, $19. It's certainly worth it. The other thing is a website called bandconditions.com, and what that is that's not a prediction of what the conditions are going to be for this day, but it's actual current conditions updated every 30 seconds. There's information on that site about, you can really get in depth if you want, but just look at the bar graphs that are there. But it's www.bandconditions.com. And one of the links on there, I think, is either about or, I don't think it says help, I think it says about. And if you click on that, it'll tell you and describe just how that particular site works. But I use that a lot before I leave the house to find out that?
If you want, I'll give you a paragraph on the Mounder minimum.
Okay, that's another good piece of information. Thank you, Eric. So, all right, tell us about the Mounder minimum, Eric. KE2EJ, K2RIW, go right ahead.
All right, this is actually on the NASA website. You guys could actually see it. What it says is, the early records of sunspots indicate the sun went through a period of inactivity. In the late today, fewer sunspots were seen on the sun from about 1645 to 17. Although the observations were not as extensive as in later years, the sun was in fact well observed and lack of sunspots well documented. The period of solar inactivity also corresponds to the climate period called the Little Ice Age, where rivers that are normally ice-free, froze, and snow fields remain year-round at lower altitudes. There is evidence that the sun had similar periods of inactivity in the more distant past. Connection between solar activity and terrestrial climate is an area of ongoing research. RIW, K3J.
Thank you, Eric. We're going to pass it back to you now, George. You're allowed to ask for fills on any of the information you've heard. It looks to me like the down period you're going through right now, it looks to me like it's going to last another couple of years before we start to really climbing back up on that sunspot cycle through getting a significant number. And some people are worried that we're going to another miniature Mounder minimum lately. There are some people who say yes, some people say no, and maybe David H. Hathaway, has more information on that. One other thing I was going to mention is that your QTH is Tarrytown, New York, and that's where the Hudson Convention used to be held a whole lot of years ago. And Tarrytown is where ARL would hold the Hudson Convention of the local group, if you know what I mean. And so your town's got a famous name. November Yankee 9, Alpha, K2RIW. And by the way, how long have you had that call, George? That's a beauty. You got it, George.
Well, thank you, Dick. I didn't wait for dings, but I'm going to make it real short here. I've had the call now for 8 months, and I actually lay in wait for this one because I could see when it was going to become available. The honorable man who had it before me had passed away, and 20 months expired, and all of a sudden it came up, and I put my oar in the water, and I got it, because after all, I'm in New York, and I'm not far from 9A, so it's kind of easy to remember your call that way. Meanwhile, let me let it drop. And now I feel better. I think you gentlemen have covered an awful lot here. And it does coincide with what I've been able to find through my own studies. But again, it is short on its predictability as far as when, if, and as the sun is ever going to come back to its performance level. I keep going by my friend, I can't remember his call, who runs a 20-meter net. And, he's been complaining about it's impossible to hear different people, different places, and it's only within the last year that it's become so awful. So I don't know, if I were you guys, I would not take any stock in global warming. It looks like with this particular phenomenon that we're up against, that global cooling is going to be the order of the day. Anyway, thank you very much for your help, and I do appreciate it, and I will try to come up with more interesting subjects as time goes by. K2RIW in the group NY9A.
Good news, George. I mean, a guy with a great call and a great question. It's only the ham radio operators that are operating below 30 megahertz, so to speak, who are heavily dependent on that ionosphere. And that's only a fraction of ham radio. There's a hell of a lot of VHF, UHF ham radio. I recommend you get into that also. You're already on 2 meters, and if you ever did pick up an all-mode 2-meter rig, make, borrow, or steal, or buy one, and you listen to what kind of range you can get out of 2-meter single sideband with a Yagi antenna and 100 watts of power, you'd be amazed how many people you've got to talk to. And so VHF, UHF is frontiers. It's a lot of ham radio is up at the higher frequencies, where you're not as dependent on the ionosphere. And you're always going to get a burst out of the sun periodically. It's going to give you some good ionospheric propagation, maybe for only a few hours on a particular day. So to have both VHF as well as HF equipment is one way to get around this, where you'll always be able to do sun-type ham radio, and just you choose what frequency to go to depending on what the sun is doing today is one possible approach. I'm primarily on VHF, UHF, because to me, that's where the frontier is. Ham radio operators, let me drop this. Every 10 or 15 years, the frontier of ham radio moves up almost 10 to 1 higher in frequency. Right now, I guess the frontier is somewhere around 10 gigs or 22 gigs is where the really progressive ham radio operators are going, because there's very little storeboard equipment. They've got to build their own transmitter, build their own receiver, build their own antenna, so to speak. And everybody you talk to there is primarily homebrew. And so, technically speaking, that makes them very interesting people to talk to. So that frontier keeps moving up in frequency. And you got one extremely progressive guy, Brian Justin, having trouble remembering his call letters right now, who's been doing quite a bit of work up by that 243 gigahertz. That's a frequency so high, when you go up there, you get a nosebleed, George. I'm making a joke about that. So there's always higher frequencies. And that's where the interesting work is going on. In the early days, people had great trouble getting up to 20 meters, 14 megahertz. You have to do, take the socket off the bottom of the tube to make the capacitance low enough to get a good transmitter to go up that high in frequency. Ham radio operators back in the 20s and 30s lived through that period where getting up to 14 megacycles was difficult. Let me drop. So we've come a long way since then. Frank is our next guy. Kilo Echo 2, Kilo Bravo. Go right ahead, Frank. K2IW in the TechNet. Wait for the four beeps. My name is Dick.
Yeah, hi, Dick. Everybody else, name is Frank. Called KE2KB. I'm in Teaneck, New Jersey. I have a question about batteries. I have a bunch of Yaesu HTs. Actually, three of them. I have an FT60R, which I'm using now. I have a VX150, and I have an old FT530. And I use the AA battery holders, the FNV25A, as my mainstay for batteries. So I can use the rechargeables, or if I need to, I can use regular alkalines or lithium. I'm wondering, what's the best battery to use? I've been using Eneloop, Panasonic Eneloop, 3MCCA, part number, 2000 milliamp hours. And I also have the FNV83 battery pack that came with the radio. That's a 1400 milliamp hour nickel metal hydride. Then I have, I just bought a set of Power X by Maha. Power X Black, 2700 milliamp hour. They are standard nickel metal hydrides. They have a higher discharge rate. So I don't know, those I think can produce more current, more instantaneous current. And then there are the lithium single-use batteries, which I haven't experimented with at all, but they're very expensive. So I'm just wondering, can anybody point me in the right direction for getting, I want to get the most power for the most amount of time out of my radio. Back to you, Dick.
Yeah, Don, interesting question, Frank. And you're in that gray zone of the trade-off between dollars versus milliampere hours versus chargeable or not rechargeable, chargeable or not rechargeable. There's a lot of pros and cons to all of the above. I bet you Eric has got some opinions on this one. Eric, which are the batteries that you know about? I mean, where you've got a battery-operated automobile, and I believe those are lithium cells. I think you've got a zillion C-size or D-size cells that I believe are lithium ion or lithium polymer running your electrically powered automobile. Although Frank is not powering an automobile, he wants to power a rig, a portable rig. So of all the battery technology that you keep track of, Eric, wonder if you have some suggestions for him. KE2EJ, and I hope you're there. Victor Raleigh W, the tech man.
Victor Raleigh W, KJ. I am now actually looking up how many milliamp hours is Kim single use lithium AA battery. Actually, if you guys put the ion, which at the beginning makes for many of the older radios, all the newer radios like this, VX7, the VX1, this stuff, there's a lithium ion battery. You get more bang for the buck, so to speak, in terms of size. What might have been a 1,000 milliamp battery size in nickel metal hydride is a 3,000 milliamp hour battery in the same size. I would say if you're doing single-use batteries, I think I got this, but a single-use lithium battery will actually give you a lot of current all at once if you want it. But, I'm looking for milliamp hours. By the way, it's lithium ion disulfide, what the composition is. Quite different from lithium rub.
Eric, if you could give us a little bit more audio, it would help. You sound beautiful, but you're a little bit low.
Sorry about that. One of the plus things about lithium single-use batteries, they actually produce a volt and a half instead of the volt and a quarter, which you'll get out of a nickel metal hydride or a NiCad, even. See why they're not. They give you the discharge profile, but they don't give us the other. Ah, here we go. Okay. What we want. At a discharge rate of 10 milliamps, capacity of the battery is about 3,500 milliamp hours. So, yeah, the lithium is the best bang for the buck in terms of time and current capability. But they're expensive. Constant current performance actually drops as they go through discharge. The point of a volt as it gets down. Now, carbon batteries are cheap. You can buy them in bulk. You can go to Home Depot and get them real cheap. As far as your radio is concerned, if you're using a carbon battery or a lithium battery, you're going to get the maximum output of your output transmission when you transmit. If you go nickel metal hydride for a given battery pack that's 7.5 volts, let's say, it'll be the discharge rate of whatever that battery is. It's a matter of how deep is your pocketbook and what do you want to carry around. KQRWK2J.
Okay, one of the highest capacity batteries that you found is that 3,000 milliampere hour lithium ion iron or something like that.
It's lithium iron, not ion. Iron disulfide.
Okay, lithium iron disulfide. You have a rough guess as to how expensive those things are. You said you get the biggest bang for the dollar. By that you meant the biggest number of milliampere hours per cell size. But what's the rough guess as to how many dollars one of those cells costs, Eric? KE2EJ, KQRIW.
KQRIW, KQEJ. When I first saw them, they were like, $2 a cell or $3 a cell, something like that. I'm sure they're cheaper now, but I'm not the person to ask. Maybe the gentleman who asked the question actually knows the price.
Now, you also keep your nose to the ground, your ear to the ground, as to what's coming over the transom on battery research. Have you been hearing hints about some kind of brand new, graphite reinforced electrode or whatever type battery, which has got super high surface area because of a whole lot of little local bumps to it, so to speak? Do you know of battery technology that's coming over the horizon that you've been hearing about that we should hold great thoughts for because it's about to get to us? What's your guess on that one, Eric? KE2EJ, KQLIW.
Well, that's actually a good one, Dick, because there's a bunch of new stuff coming out. But what we're going to see more of, which we'll actually find in a Tesla or a Nissan Leaf, is lithium polymer batteries. It's basically the printed sheet. Way it works. It's made out of these polymers that are sort of like plastic. And the way it's constructed is basically they're rolled together. They're flat. They're not very thick. They have a tremendous amount of current to current capability. You can draw hundreds of amps from these things. And it's pretty amazing. And that's what's making the vehicle vehicle to be able to hold enough energy to drive a 100 kilowatt motor for a whole lot of hours. So that's the up and coming stuff. We're seeing lithium polymer in other forms of
Yeah, give us a little bit more audio, and I think I've heard that somebody is coming out with an electric vehicle with 600 miles of range. Over to you, Eric.
Yeah, what they're using is lithium polymer batteries, and that technology is getting better and better as they make more and more. Elon Musk manufactures his own batteries, just as Nissan manufactures their own batteries, and they do it in Tennessee, by the way. If you're interested in seeing how that process works, there's a number of YouTube videos that you can go look at. It's really quite interesting. There's a couple of other interesting YouTube videos where they actually take a crashed Nissan Leaf and rip the batteries apart and reconfigure them to use on a motorcycle. The 600 mile range car is not really that far off. The Chevy is showing a 300 mile range, fully electric Volt as opposed to the gasoline shared powered Volt. And then there's Tesla is coming out with their 600 mile range. Right now they've got a 300 mile range car, so you know it's getting there. Again, the most efficient battery, the one that gives you the most, but is not convenient because you can't recharge it in the conventional way. You still haven't beat the power curve on that thing yet. Maybe one day. It's RWK3J.
Yeah, that's an interesting little tickler you gave us. That zinc air, if they can solve the problem, you know, would in double A size of that, instead of 3,000 milliampere hours, it might get 4,000 or 5,000. What's your guess if they can solve the zinc air problem, Eric?
I don't think you can physically make a zinc air the size of a double A battery. They're rather large. Talking about you know, high current, high capacity for like a motor vehicle, something of that nature. The way you recharge it is you actually have to pull the core out and redeposit material on it, so on and so forth. A number of people have created the process for manufacturing, but nobody ain't doing it yet.
Okay, I thank you, Eric. I'm going to pass it back to Frank. Frank, you're allowed to ask any fill-in questions or whatever on what you've just heard. Darn good question. And Frank, I'd like you, as you do your research on this, because we amateurs just love portable equipment and mountaintopping and beachfront in the woods and whatever. As you get further downrange with your battery research, I'd like you to check in with us periodically and tell us what you found. Kilo Echo 2, Kilo Bravo, K2LAW. Go ahead, Frank.
This is KE2KV back. Yeah, it's unfortunate. My budget is not too good, so I can't do too much experimenting. But I just paid $24 for a set of 8 of these PowerX rechargeables, and I'm now experimenting with these. But unfortunately, these batteries won't fit my Yaesu FT60R. They just won't fit the battery pack. I mean, they fit in the pack, in the holder, but then the holder won't go into the radio. And I found out with the little caliper that I have, the batteries are 1/20th of a centimeter longer. The outside of the battery, the actual casing of the battery, is 1/20th of a centimeter longer than the enteloop, and therefore it pushes on the plastic sides of the battery case, and it won't fit in the FT60. It might fit in the VX150, because it's an older radio, and for some reason the specs are a little bit loose, but this radio is really tight as far as what will fit. And this is with the OEM, you know, FNB25A battery pack, not the old cheap